Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies. My name is Sarah Bramau Ramos, and I am one of the hosts on the channel. And I'm joined today by Andres Rodriguez to talk about his new book, Frontier Fieldwork, Building a Nation in China's Borderlands, 1919 to 1945. Welcome to New Books, Andres, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Hi, Sarah, and thank you so much for taking time to talk about my book. I'm very, very grateful.
Of course. So why don't we go ahead and start, as is tradition on the channel, with your beginning. So how did you come to work on Chinese history and modern Chinese history specifically?
Sure. So this story has two parts. We need to go back in time to 1992 when I was a high school student in Hong Kong. And this was my first trip to China. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, most people go to Beijing, Shanghai, but I actually went to Kunming in Yunnan, taking the train from Guangzhou. And that was my first encounter and interest in China, because what I encountered as a 17-year-old was the world of ethnic minorities, meeting old Chinese Christians who were, you know, obviously had learned English from the missionary days. I remember someone who had learned English with American soldiers who worked on the airfields. So for someone who, you know, actually at that time spoke no Chinese, but obviously very impressionable, you know, I was very, really captivated by this particular world. And I think that trip was so important that it really made me be determined that I wanted to make China part of my life. So that brings us to the second part, which was having done a BA in history back home in Chile, I got a scholarship to go study a master's in modern Chinese studies at Oxford. So I pretty much began fairly late to study Chinese, but I was very fortunate to work with Rana Mitter, who really opened this world of Republican China, you know, the China between 1912 in 1949, because I guess we have to remember that that's almost 20 years ago, actually, you know, access to archives and to China in general, you know, was so open that, of course, it's why, you know, so much scholarship has been produced from those times. And I think that was really that really big introduction into modern Chinese history. And Oxford obviously has something else to offer, because it was also where one day while I was making some photocopies, you know, this is obviously before the days where, you know, now is everything is scanned and everything is on PDF, that, you know, I was photocopying something and I look around and I see this bound leather volume of this journal called the Journal of the West China Border Research Society. And there it was. It was really the beginning of this project, of this book, and my interest in particular in West China and Sichuan in particular.
Great. So you find that journal. It's always great to, you know, work with the resources that are there in your institution around you. So how did you come to find that journal and get to the book? So what did the middle part look like for you? And in particular, I'm interested about the sort of the writing part. What did going from that journal to your own monograph, what did that journey look like?
I think one way to describe this is full circle. I began with missionaries and I end with missionaries. And the reason I'm saying this is that the book began as a project about missionaries exploring this particular area of West China. And as the research expanded and more archives, both in China and around the world, began to be part of this project, I began to conceive this more as a project in terms of practice. Essentially, how do different people in China approach this particular region that I'm looking at? And what do each of these characters, so to speak, bring to the field? And I think that was very important to determine the structure of the book, because essentially, while it is chronological from 1919 to 1945, each chapter is attempting to highlight and showcase one particular archetype of the field worker that I've encountered at the time. So, you know, as we'll probably be discussing later, you know, there's obviously, you know, local Chinese scholars, it's the missionaries, it's the anthropologists, it's the students. And I think that was one important aspect of, which was very difficult at the beginning, to how do I structure this particular, you know, book. The other thing that I think was very important in determining the rupture in the narrative, because although the book only has five chapters, at least for me, the key moment of a shift is World War II, right? It's the Japanese invasion 1937, which determined a before and after in the structure of the book as well. And that's probably why I decided to finish with that end year of 1945, because the story after that is really for another article, another book. And I think that's important when you're thinking about the book. You already want to think about, you know, what's going to be happening next, you know, in terms of that project you have in your mind, or what might be kind of waiting for you in that pile of papers that need to be read. But the reason I said full circle is that, and I think this probably is common for most of us, is that you do in the end write the introduction at the very end, right? You know, you have the structure, you have the chapters out, and then you want to write your introduction. And without really setting out to do this, it kind of turned out, you know, as you probably read this introduction, you find out that the missionary was at the core. It always was at the core of what this book was about. And I'm assuming that people who read the book may or may not agree with this. It may raise a few eyebrows. You know, it may actually kind of almost come out to be a bit missionary centric. But I stand by, you know, what I claim in the book, that the missionary is such an influential archetype, you know, for Chinese scholars, officials. The presence is so particular in an area where most Han Chinese, you know, very reticent to actually visit, that it really is influential in shaping ideas of how is it that we're meant to engage with this world. And maybe even, you know, someone like Elizabeth Perry, you know, she wrote an article, which I don't see often cited, but of course I cite her, which talks about how even early communists, you know, looked at the missionaries as this model. So I obviously invite people to read the book, but when you do so, just keep in mind that the missionary is always there with you in every chapter. And I think that was important in terms of how to keep that red thread, you know, which again, you know, came as one of the questions from the reviewers, which again is also a very important process of that writing as well.
Mm-hmm. You're mentioning the pile of papers, and, you know, you touched on a little bit there, you know, there's so many people in this book. There are students and photographers and travelers and anthropologists and all, you know, all kinds of missionaries, all kinds of different people. But before we get into, you know, the people who made it into the book, I'm kind of curious to know, who was there anyone who didn't make it, or any particular, you know, type of figure who got just left in the pile of papers? Like, was there who got left on the cutting room floor, I guess, and in a different way of asking, was there anyone who just didn't make it that you thought from the beginning, this person's going to be here?
Well, that's, I think it goes back to who was in the dissertation and who makes it to the book, right? Well, there's one fascinating character, and, you know, I tend to use the word fascinating quite a lot, but it was a Izu, a member of the Izu elite, the ethnicity group. His name was Lang Guangdia. I think he's briefly mentioned in the book, and he came up a lot in my research, you know, on the Yi people, and even, of course, the field workers who are engaging, you know, with the various Yi communities as well. But in the end, he and his network, you know, of people who are engaging with the Kuomintang, they were transferred, so to speak, to a different article. Because, of course, while you want to talk about everybody, you know, who's intrigued you and fascinates you, it didn't quite fit, you know, with what the book was actually about.
Great. Thank you for that. With that, because you've set us up so nicely, why don't we dive a little bit further into your book itself? So as you laid out, this book looks at the early 20th century. And you find China in this book being gripped by a concern over the nation. So as you show in the book, the story that you're telling is how China, in the face of new threats and new claims over China's former imperial borders, people are struggling and trying to figure out how to integrate, how to reintegrate, and just how to think about frontier territories. So you follow through this book, the photographers, travelers, missionaries, as we've been touching on, how they engaged in frontier work and placed China's margins at the center of this idea of the Chinese nation. There's a lot going on in this time period. But I'm hoping for listeners who might not be so familiar with, what was happening in 1919, could you give listeners a sense of, what they need to know? So without diving into all of the history, what are some of the key points about what is happening in China, but in, specifically the Sino-Tibetan borderland?
I think I'll start by talking a bit about the region, the area. So when we're talking about the Sino-Tibetan borderlands, we're talking about the eastern borders of the Tibetan plateau. Maybe an easier way to talk about this is to look at a map, look at Sichuan, look at where you see Tibet on the map in today's, PRC. And it's that contact zone between the area of western Sichuan and eastern Tibet. And I think contact zone is the right term to use here, because particularly at that time, this is a zone where we have many worlds and many centers, right? We have a Tibetan world, a Han Chinese world. And of course, when I say Tibetan, of course, I'm obviously generalizing here, because of course, within that world, there are smaller polities that have, different loyalties. Sometimes they don't have any loyalty at all, right? And they look, in terms of asserting their own power as well. And I think what we need to understand with this particular region, as a contact zone, is that the events of not only 1919, but even if we go towards the end of the 19th century, that there's a big shift in how, for example, the Qing dynasty is looking at these border areas. And I always like, quoting Greg Tuttle's work and how he talks about the shifts in Tibet and this frontier area. And he talks about these global forces, of imperialism and trade. And I think that is very much an important part of the picture of this book, that it's not only about how the Qing and later the Chinese Republic are dealing with these domestic challenges on its frontier, it's also how the international, how the changing international system is posing very different challenges that have a direct effect on these frontier areas. So one shift that we need to think about is governance, the ways that rather than relying on indirect rule with, the so-called Tusi system, these local or native leaders, as they usually called in the literature, the Qing dynasty, in light of what they see as a threat of British imperialism, for example, they begin to enforce something known in Chinese as the Gai Tu Kui Liu, which is the removal of local leaders and the assertion of direct control. I don't think we have time to go into great detail, about what happens at the time. What I can say is that, the vision behind this is to assert a new sense of control, sovereignty, which is closely linked with ideas that are very common, of course, in the early 20th century as well, of agricultural colonies, land reclamation. And this is why we need to think about the global. We need to think about how the Japanese are settling their own frontiers in Hokkaido, in terms of agriculture. And that does have a direct effect in the shaping of how people in China are seeing their border regions as well. Fast forward a little bit, I think, to 1919. Now, it's interesting, I choose this year. And of course, a lot of people will see this year in the obvious light of the May 4th movement, this moment of an upsurge of Chinese nationalism, which of course is a response to territory being taken away from the Chinese and not being given back, right? In the context of German settlements in Qingdao and then the Japanese taking it over rather than bringing them back to China, which of course was an ally during the Great War as well. So this is part of the dilemma. This is part of the anxiety that I talk about. There's very much in the minds of this, you know, newly, you know, active actor, which, for example, are students, intellectuals in China. And of course, it's an uproar that we see mostly in the cities. But the events of 1919 also, you know, have an effect in these areas that I study as well. And what is happening, of course, we see increased militarization. We see a fragmented authority. And what we see really, you know, in contrast to, you know, maybe in the cities, is that what we see here are regional militarists, which, you know, we usually call warlords. But as I may refer to, once again, I know we're also interested in talking about the writing of the book. There was a discussion with the reviewers about whether warlords is the right word, because it's hard with this kind of sense of not being legitimate rulers. And I think it's fair to say that I refer to them as regional militarists, because this is what they are. People who have a distinct vision of how to rule China, you know, with an iron fist, and of course, with this vision of militarizing society as well. So 1919, what does 1919 mean for these borderlands? Well, obviously, it refers to a moment of conflict, of very fuzzy and unclear boundaries, of military, you know, confrontation between these two worlds, between China and Tibet. And just a reminder, you know, in 1914, we have the signing of the Simla Convention, which was meant to establish the boundaries between Tibet and China. And of course, the Chinese Republic doesn't sign this convention, which again, a lot about the uncertainties that exist at the time. I think the last thing I want to say in terms of setting up, you know, the context is that 1919 is also important in these new ideas that have come about of what we sometimes call the Wilsonian moment, right? Ideas of self-determination, you know, a large discourse of racial equality, which I'm sure many people know, you know, is also linked to Sun Yat-sen's own ideas, you know, of how we need to really refound and reestablish the international system on equal standing. But these ideas of racial equality, self-determination, they also make their way to these border areas. They are embraced by local elites, that like the Yi people that I mentioned earlier. And they're also on the agenda, you know, of these militarists, you know, in terms of the discourse that they bring, in terms of how they see this frontier area needs to be built and reconstructed.
Mm-hmm. You're talking there about, you know, China in the global, and it struck me reading your book that there's also quite a bit, you know, going on globally in terms of thinking about what is knowledge and how to gather knowledge and what is science and what is anthropology, what is ethnography, how do we do that? And that's something, again, that's usually, well, at least as I have read it elsewhere, it's usually talked about as a city story. And here again, it's sort of the idea of what is knowledge being explored and played out on the frontier. Is that something else you would you know, think about when you're thinking about how to place this in sort of the global, that idea of, you know, changing ideas of knowledge and knowledge making?
I certainly see throughout, you know, the various actors that I've studied, is that knowledge, you know, is bound to nations. I think that is very clear in the Chinese understanding. And it brings a lot of anxiety that the production of knowledge of frontier areas or sensitive areas by people who come from outside, you know, is usually seen as very problematic. You know, problematic in that, you know, on the one hand, it seems to display certain, you know, asymmetry between, you know, people who, you know, live in a territory and have no knowledge of these areas that they're supposed to actually, you know, understand. And of course, the knowledge that is in the hands of people who usually associated, you know, with other agendas, such as, you know, imperialist or colonialist domination. So I think there's a lot to be said about, you know, again, that often cited as a mantra of knowledge is power. That's certainly the case, I think, in that, you know, I always remember, and I think I quoted in my book, that when it came to Manchuria, for example, right, you know, one of the anxieties that a lot of Chinese scholars, you know, would show as evidence is that the Japanese has such a thorough knowledge and, you know, and has such a detailed amount of books published on Manchuria that were very much absent, you know, on the bookshelves of you know, of Chinese scholars. And I think it serves as this kind of stimulus, you know, to bring about to almost some, you know, electrify a sense of that we need to create our own knowledge production, right? Bound within the confines of this, emerging Chinese geobody. And of course, the problem with it is that, it creates these artificial boundaries anyway, right? And I think that's something that, we can discuss later when we look at the Chinese anthropologists and their own sense of knowledge production and also of the discipline itself, right? Because what anthropology means, for people in, Great Britain might mean something very different, for people in China.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely fascinating. You're talking there about, what did knowledge mean and what did people think they were doing, which brings us really nicely, actually, because that's a thread that comes up in chapter one, where you were talking not quite about anthropologists, but about scholars. So chapter one, I'll just set it up a little bit, Soldiers and Scholars on the Frontier, looks at what is going on in the area of Kham? And you note that, local authorities in the area are viewing the colonization of this area as being essential. So there's lots going on that requires military authority. So some of the objectives that are being pursued involve building railways, recovering lost land, resettling land, overthrowing unequal treaties. But at the same time, there's also a real interest, as you were sort of hinting at in your answer to my last question, on drawing on local knowledge, which is where the scholars come in. So could you talk a little bit about who these scholars are? What did they understand their role to be in this vision of frontier governance? What were they trying to do?
Great. I think you set it up nicely, right? In terms of the role of the military. And I think, when I was toying around with the title for the chapter, Soldiers and Scholars not only sounds nice, I think, alliteration, but what I was...
We love alliteration.
But what I was trying to get at was that, there's this very important symbiosis between militarist rule and how civilian scholars adapt to that particular framework. Now, why does this matter? Well, I think the first thing that is important to say, particularly for people who may not be that familiar with China, is that warlords or militarists are rarely seen in a positive light, right? I think the conversation has shifted a bit, I think, in the last years, in that obviously not all these militarists are the same, that some of them, while they rule obviously with certain authoritarian view, they were committed to a certain aspect of building institutions and, mass education and so forth. But what I'm trying to say here is that for these particular scholars that I'm looking at, Ren Naiqiang or Hu Heru, who are, first of all, I should say, they're local scholars, right? They're from Sichuan, not necessarily from these frontier areas, but they're from Sichuan province. And at least in the case of Hu Heru, it's interesting how, at least I've seen this in his memoir, that he saw militarism as a natural solution, as the best means of enacting action, on these very problematic areas of China, right? So, and of course, most scholars, civilians, were usually repulsed by militarism, right? Because, of course, the various atrocities that they committed. Here we have, a scholar who is committed, to his type of service, so to speak, and sees someone like Liu Wenhui as someone who can enable this rather than, destroy this. So I think that's one thing that very important to set up in this chapter. And when we look at the thread that's behind these two scholars, I mean, first of all, as you very well say, they are not anthropologists. They're not trained as anthropologists. And yet what they do may look like pretty much ethnography in the field. But when you look at what they actually went and studied, and this I was very, very fortunate to have interviewed Ren Xinjian, who was the son, who hopefully is the son of Ren Naiqiang. And when I met him in Chengdu, he explained very carefully that, his father had studied in Beijing, had studied, agricultural sciences, and because this is what people did in the 1920s. And again, here again, we bring in the global. I mean, this is a model that was very common in Japan. And of course, we have this phrase, building a country based on agriculture. This is very much the ethos that I think is in the minds of these particular scholars. And these are the disciplines, agriculture, economics, and most importantly, geography. I mean, geography really is essential for many of these scholars who see that the study of landscape and the relation between the landscape and the people is very important if we want to assert control or colonize these particular areas of China. And Renai Chang says something that we see in many other writings of, you know, Western explorers, which is this idea of the blank, you know, and that Dane Kennedy, you know, has that very, that well-known book called The Last Blank Spaces. Now, his book is talking about Africa, talk about Australia. And that idea of the blank, of course, is also very problematic because, of course, what it's doing really, it doesn't acknowledge any of the already existing, you know, local population, you know, local knowledge, you know, of maps, or at least of territory, of space, and so forth. But going back to the chapter, Renai Chang, his experience was that he was horrified to find that there were these blanks, at least in Chinese scholarship, of the geographies that you could find in these areas of West Sichuan and the area of Kham. So someone like him will set about on a mission to survey these regions, you know, with very precarious instruments, you know, with a few assistants. And he'll go about, you know, on these tours, you know, going through these, again, what is already established as these particular units of counties, but he'll go about surveying the landscape and, of course, will produce these maps, which again become very helpful and important, you know, for Li Wenhui, who, of course, is, you know, is in charge of this area. And what's important, I think, as well to mention about people like Ren or Hu is their immersion in the region. And I think this is a bit of the narrative that we see quite often about frontier in China, particularly in the 20th century, where there's a call for the Han Chinese scholar to, and I think we see this in the West, Western countries as well, the idea that the armchair scholar, you know, is beginning to be a relic of the past. You need to get out of that chair, you know, you need to put on, you know, whatever you need to put on in terms of your suit or your special whatever, and go into the field and be there, immerse yourself. This is the only way to really understand what is happening. And Renai Chang, of course, he actually marries someone local. He marries Luo Zhouqingzuo, who is part of the local elite in the region, right? And of course, this allows him to immerse himself in the actual language. It's not clear. Something I would have really liked to know about is what kind of collaboration existed in terms of his own fieldwork through those new family connections that he actually began to build. And of course, Lara McConney has an excellent article on Luo Zhouqingzuo that some people listening might want to explore as well. But one thing I would add, I think, in terms of what these scholars bring is that while, you know, understandably, they are part of this colonial enterprise, so to speak, I think we have to be very clear about that, they do also become advocates, you know, for a particular type of local or, in this sense, Kham identity, particularly in the early post-war period, which again is probably another part of the story that doesn't quite get told in the book, but that will be told, you know, in articles that hopefully, you know, will be coming out sometime soon.
Great. So there's two things there that really struck me, sort of, you know, very much encapsulate and sort of identify the scholars that you're looking at here. They're, you know, part of who they are as you set it up. So geography is being essential, and that idea of filling in the gaps, and also going out in the field. And those two things, you know, they apply to the scholars, but they also apply to the missionaries that you look at in the next chapter, because you talked about missionaries before, and here's where we sort of see them. You talk in this particular chapter, chapter two, you talk about missionary explorers, and in particular, the work being done by the West China Border Research Society. So there's a lot here in this chapter about the society, who the different members were, and you talk about, you know, that they are a disparate group in some ways. They have different approaches. Some were more religion first, some were more scientific, but they all sort of coalesce around geography being essential and needing to go out and experience it. And you actually have this great quote that I'm going to read here you have a great quote from the society's first president, where they describe West China as quote, an anthropological paradise, a zoological Eden, a floral place of bliss, a teeming laboratory of countless specimens for the medical worker, the physicist, the chemist, biologist, sociologist, economist, geologist, mineralogist, botanist, linguist, religious worker, but why enumerate all the possibilities? End quote. Which I just love. So you have, you know, so many different kinds of missionary explorers and different people in this chapter. But if you had to narrow it down, could you introduce just one to the listener? Who are they, and what are they doing in this zoological Eden?
I mean, after listening to that quote, don't you want to go to West China right now? It certainly, you know, excited me at the time. Well, before I go into the actual character that I have in mind, I think it's worth explaining that first two things. I think one, that missionaries are long-term residents, right? They're different to explorers, you know, different to both the Han Chinese explorers may come in and out, but also to these other explorers that come from these international scientific missions as well. And I think that's important to emphasize, because where do you draw the line between them being outsiders, which they still are, but also part of the local scene as well? And I think one thing that I, you know, really explored in that chapter is that missionaries will really kind of attach themselves to this idea that this is what makes them unique, that unique connection to the communities that they study that really no one else can really aspire to, unless you actually live and commit yourselves with that sense of devotion and service. Now, if I were to choose one missionary, I think it would have to be David Crockett Graham, who was this American Baptist who arrives to China in the 1910s. And for most of the period up until the wartime period around 1943-44, he is stationed in this area of West Sichuan. I think it's important to clarify that it's not that they live in the actual border regions that they're exploring. You know, a lot of them actually live in Chengdu. Of course, it's a very important city in West Sichuan, because this is where we had the West China Union University, which was this very particular institution that brought a number of missionary denominations, you know, working together. So in itself, it's a very international, you know, enterprise that's being set up in this particular part of the Chinese world. But why choose Graham? Well, I think there's many reasons to choose Graham. He is different from the earlier generation of missionaries who are very much, you know, solid training in theology, but pretty much amateurs when it came to that kind of field work that they were conducting in the field. And of course, you know, there's a lot of those, you know, taking, you know, doing that kind of work in other continents as well. But Graham is different. You know, he's part of that new generation who has a PhD. You know, he studies comparative religion in the University of Chicago. He studies under Faye Cooper Cole, who himself had been, you know, a student, a disciple of Franz Boas. And of course, what I'm trying to get here is that Graham not only brings, you know, a sense of, you know, of theology, of obviously of this duty of conversion, but also brings in this anthropological sensitivity of, you know, ideas of salvage anthropology, you know, this idea that, you know, it's important that we need to salvage the remains of the past that are very, very much bound to disappear in this very, this quickly changing world. And that's very much what you see in his writings, in how he approaches, you know, the communities that he engages with. But Graham is also interesting in terms of what he presents as one example of internationalism. So when I say internationalism in China, most people will think I'm talking about communism, which of course is the best example of internationalism, you know, at its best, maybe, or worse, I don't know, in China. But when it came to these other types of internationalism, we can see how a, you know, strain of a type of, you know, liberalism, of international cooperation in education. We look at the networks that someone like Graham, who's stationed this, you know, these various parts of Sichuan, but he is essentially, you know, a collector for the Smithsonian Institution, among other things. You know, he collects specimens. There is, you know, I do mention how he even will collect human skulls, which of course, you know, at this day of age, you know, is something that, you know, brings a lot of ethical questions. But he also, of course, is very well connected. You know, there are many descriptions of how he will go around, you know, during the summers, right? He will go into the, you know, the hills, into the mountains. He will reconnect with the local Miao communities that he knew very well. And this is where these conversations begin, right? Where, you know, he will negotiate, buy certain items from them. And he gets to know them so well that even when he's passed away and his descendants go back to China, the Chuan Mao community, you know, receive them, you know, with honors, because that, you know, Graham was a very important part of their history as well. I think it's also important to remember that someone like Graham, you know, he was a curator for the West China University Museum of Art Anthropology, sorry, Art Archaeology and Ethnology. And his role at the museum is extremely important because I would argue that he was able to put the idea of the frontier on display as a way to introduce the frontier to the Han Chinese world. And it's very important that in the travelogues that I've looked at of these various journalists that come, you know, to Sichuan, they come from various areas of the coast, from Shanghai, they always come to the museum. They may not like it that the missionaries are in charge. They may, you know, bring certain prejudice against them. But they do acknowledge that this production of frontier knowledge, you know, is a powerful one, and that it is able to introduce the frontier and even educate people about these areas of China that most people in other parts of China are not quite familiar or aware of.
I think he's such an interesting person. And he, you know, through him, through his networks, you're really able to sort of, again, point to sort of, you know, China being connected to the global, as we were talking a little bit about before, right? It's very much that that wider, you know, wider global, you know, changes and stories that are going on all played out in this area. So it's a fascinating chapter. And thank you for highlighting him. You were mentioning there sort of Han Chinese scholars and, you know, their writings. And this is something that you touch on and look at a little bit more deeply in chapter 3. And I'm just going to mark it here as sort of being the chapter that holds this, because chapter 3 really looks at Han Chinese scholars who have caught, as you say in the book, frontier fever, and then, you know, report from the field what they see. So in this chapter, you look a lot at their travel writing and what they're, you know, how they are expressing these. They're very, I almost want to say romantic, but, you know, they're very enthusiastic reports and travels to these frontier regions. But so that sort of, you know, occupies chapter 3. But then move us to chapters 4 and 5, which look at a whole new type of person who is being mobilized and moved to the frontier. This is where we meet the anthropologists that we've been hinting on and touching on in different parts of our conversation. So chapter 4, Chinese Anthropologists at War, looks at the mobilization of social anthropologists during the War of Resistance and their efforts in promoting nation-building projects on China's frontiers as, you know, part of their larger war efforts. So in thinking about what these anthropologists are doing, could you unpack this a little bit? What did they think they were doing? How did they see their studies, their work on the frontiers as contributing to the war effort?
Well, this was probably one of the most exciting chapters that I worked on, particularly because the first materials that I really found were from the Rockefeller Foundation, who were behind this particular enterprise, so to speak, and very much gave a lot of the funding that allowed these projects to kind of take place at the time. So already we go into the global, right, in terms of anthropology as part of a global war effort. And one of the things that I quote in my book is this letter, right, between Fei Xiaotong, who's this very well-known anthropologist, you know, with one of his colleagues in the U.S., and that description of this American scholar who talks about how everyone has been mobilized. You know, all anthropologists, you know, been sent off almost like soldiers. Egypt, you know, the Pacific Islands, they all had this mission, you know, to carry out in terms of building anthropological knowledge to serve the needs of the war of the wartime state. And I think that's how we need to place the work of these particular Chinese anthropologists. But I think it's important to remember that when we look at these anthropologists that I'm looking at, and I think it's important to emphasize that I'm not speaking for all of them, okay? Mm. There is an emphasis on a particular school of those who were in Beijing prior to the invasion of the Japanese in 1937. Of course, Beijing at the time was known as Beiping. The capital was in Nanjing in the south. And what we need to understand is that if you live in Beiping, or maybe just keep it easier, say Beijing. If you live in Beijing in the 1920s and 30s, you have that overwhelming shadow and fear of the Japanese coming into Manchuria, right? Mm. And I think, you know, when I look at one of these scholars, Wu Wenzhao, one of his students recalls when she's writing the preface to her thesis that she's very grateful to Wu Wenzhao, who, you know, back in Beijing, was always reminding students to study the frontier, that it was very important for the survival of China, because look what's happening in Manchuria. You know, this is something that has caught us, you know, in a very weak position. Mm. So this kind of work is really meant to build up the foundations, you know, of knowledge, of later on practical application that can kind of help stem this particular, you know, wave of Japanese incursions. So that's one way to think about where these scholars come from. The other aspect we need to think about is that they're refugees. Now, they have to leave Beijing. They are accidental anthropologists who make their way to the southwest, also the northwest as well. And that in some cases, studying the frontier was not really originally on their agenda. You know, many of them were interested in, obviously, the hot topic of the time, which was rural reconstruction. Their real motivations was, how can we study rural society in China, intervene in society, in this particular aspect of society, as a way to accommodate these changes that are taking place within, you know, the onslaught of, you know, capital, trade, you know, modernization. So it's this kind of experience and baggage that they bring with them to the frontier. So that's one thing that is also important to set up as well. So what are they doing in the frontier? You know, you know, other than having to reshift their whole agenda, you know, in terms of this emergency mode. Well, I think what they bring and what they see themselves as people who need to contribute to the war effort. That's very clear. You know, that what's happening in Manchuria, you know, can happen in China's southwest as well. So there's now a need to go into the areas of the, you know, the Yi people of Liangshan, you know, known as well as the Lolos, maybe that's more common in that kind of literature at the time, or go into areas of Tibet, which again have always been a site of contestation as well. And what you see in their writings and their studies is that they also bring about this language of Sun Yat-sen. You know, we talked a bit about Sun Yat-sen early on, you know, ideas of racial equality, but Sun Yat-sen always talked about reconstruction. You know, he talked about the importance of reconstructing China. And when you look at these various articles and studies of these Chinese anthropologists, they are talking about bringing the idea of reconstructing the frontier. Following a blueprint of sorts of what Sun Yat-sen was trying to envisage for China. And what is this blueprint about? Well, I think it's very clear in the writings of Wu Wenzhao, Lian Zhai, that they try to bring a new understanding and bring a centrality to culture, and not so much of race in the sense of a biological understanding of race. And that's very important because, of course, it's all about race, isn't it, in the Chinese nation. It's all about who we are, you know, are we just a Han Chinese nation? Are we a multi-ethnic nation? And even if we are, we recognize a certain diversity in this original understanding of the so-called five races. You know, there's an argument that some people in the Kuomintang will make, you know, that, you know, at the core, we all belong, even biologically, to the same, you know, type of nation as well. So the shift to culture, I think, is an important one, you know, that tries to highlight and also provide a certain type of agency to these local communities that are being studied. So in many ways, these are scholars that are standing up against a crude form of assimilation. I say crude form because in no way are these anthropologists trying to foster a sense of self-determination. In no way do they see areas of Tibet, you know, that they should actually, you know, be independent. That's certainly not on their agenda. They are, at core, Chinese nationalists. They are trying to really, you know, going back to that introduction in chapter one, bring back these pieces of the Lei Qing Empire back into this idea of a Chinese nation, but obviously, and hopefully, as they see it, on very different terms. So they're against assimilation. They're much more sensitive to local conditions. You know, one example is education. You know, they're very much invested. Lian Zhai, for example, when he is in Labrang, you know, in the area of the northwest, and he's studying the monastery, you know, as a model of education. But he not only is trying to understand what the monastery means in terms of education for Tibetan monks, he also extracts from that, you know, what lessons can we learn for the Han Chinese as well. Now, he's probably very unique in that, but again, what we see here is someone who is immersing himself in this world of Tibetan Buddhism and tries to see that even religion, which is usually vilified, you know, both by the Kuomintang and of course by the communists, as having great potential, you know, to bring a certain sense of meaning to the secular, you know, in terms of, you know, what education can provide. Which again is quite a stinging critique of modernity, you know, which I find very, very, very particular of Lian Zhai.
Speaking of education, and actually accidental anthropologists, you focus, you know, you've set up chapter four beautifully, and chapter five actually looks at the same period, roughly the same period as you just, you know, unpacked so nicely here. But it focuses on students. This is where the education comes in. And we're coming to the end of our conversation, but I desperately want to ask about them because I was fascinated by them and, again, what they're doing, but also their training. So you talk quite a bit in this chapter about how they were, you know, trained in the basics of fieldwork, given sandals, and basically sent off. So I was, again, fascinated by the idea of being a student sort of brought into this world, given sandals, and just sent off into the wilds, as you like. And I'm curious how you sort of found or encountered these students. As you started digging into them, was there anything that surprised you about the texts they were trained with or the tools that they were given, or maybe the tools that they weren't given? Was there anything in particular that struck you about their experiences of accidental anthropology?
You know, I was listening to your question, a few things came to mind, which might take us first to the Pacific Islands, if that's okay. Because everything seems to be very accidental, you know, in the workings of this wartime state. Why the Pacific Islands? Because one thing that I learned while I was at the Smithsonian Institution many years ago doing my research was how the Smithsonian, you know, in its, I think, very, you know, what's the word, clever attempt to use the resources that were existing at the time to secure specimens from the Pacific Islands, is that they built up a booklet that could be sent to soldiers stationed in these areas to do specimen collecting for them. Okay, so basically what the Smithsonian was doing was asking, you know, American soldiers who had very, very limited education to read the book. The book even came with his ruler, you know, embedded as well, to collect specimens, you know, with the kit and send them back, you know, to Washington. Now, what does that have to do with the students? Well, it's the same logic, right? You know, in that you have these human resources that, you know, at your disposal, at this case, at the disposal of the wartime state, and what can they actually contribute to in terms of what the wartime state actually needs? So these students, who are they? Well, you see, they do have an education. That they're very different to the American GI, you know, who's born on the Pacific Islands. They obviously come from urban China, most of them, they're from the coast. So even having them move from, let's say, Shanghai, Nanjing, Beijing to you know, to a place like Chengdu, which is not quite frontier, you know, is already shocking in its own right. You know, really, or to Kunming, of course, in Yunnan province. So students are already, on the one hand, having a culture shock of what this other part of China is. But also, I think, as I argue in that chapter, they're also rediscovering different meanings of China as well. So they are, I think, in many ways, pressure cooker anthropologists. You know, they only have about 2 weeks of training. They are, of course, they're not forced to do this. They're volunteers. The ones I focus on, they do come from Christian, again, missionary institutions. So I think they kind of tap into a sense of service that is very important at the time, but also taps into this, I think, wider May 4th ethos of young students who were very willing to go into the countryside, you know, reach out to the peasants. In this case, these students are kind of, you know, building on that earlier practice, in this case, going out to the frontier and reaching out to ethnic minorities, you know, that were in these areas. Were they trained well enough? I don't think anything could have prepared them for the culture shock. And in many ways, I don't want to use the word narcissistic, but I think this is very much about them and not so much about the people they encounter. I think, you know, in a very, I'm not sure what the word to use here, but the Kuomintang, I think, had an issue with students. They wanted to discipline the student body. And one way of doing this was to keep them busy, you know, with, you know, mobilizing them and sending them off to do this type of different work. So frontier work, you know, which is a term I use often in the book, is seen as a way, I think, to motivate students to go into these areas, reach out to the masses, which in this case would be these ethnic minority communities, and try to understand their situation and bring essentially, you know, the benefits, as we probably, you know, look, you know, back and express this as a sense of a civilizing mission of sorts. And of course, how exactly do you prepare people to do this? I mean, I'm not aware that they had any actual language training. So that's obviously one limitation, probably very, very basic. They are told to undergo very harsh conditions. And this is why I think the emphasis is really on the discipline that this practice actually provided, because as you say, they have to wear sandal shoes, you know, which had a pragmatic reason, right? Because it gives you a better grip, you know, on this kind of rugged landscape, so to speak. They were meant to keep diaries, which unfortunately I had no access to, but they were meant to document, you know, what each day by day was bringing to them in terms of this actual frontier experience. But I think there is that romantic aspect. I think that that's very, very clear. But I think, to be honest, there was probably a lot more of grumbling and complaining, whinging. Because at least, you know, in the memoirs of one of the leading teachers, you know, that took them there, you know, the complaint, of course, is that these areas, you know, were dirty. You know, they were full of, insects. You know, it was hard work, which again, for some people, hard work is what builds character. But again, it's not quite the experience that many people perhaps were expecting. I mean, I may maybe a bit sarcastic, right? You know, maybe a bit too harsh with the students. But I think they, you know, in the end, they are driven by a sense of mission, a sense to reach out to communities where they can bring a new idea of education, of medical work. And there is apparently some success in at least laying the foundations for this. And I think what we see here are the seeds of what we later call development, you know, which is a term that's really taking off in the 40s. And I think that link that you can make between the Peace Corps, you know, those young Americans who were sent off to areas around the world of the Cold War, this is really, you know, you know, a good example of that perhaps naive, you know, well-intentioned, not necessarily well-prepared, you know, training. And again, it's really more about what, it's not so much what it brings to the community, it's what it really brings to this particular type of youth, which of course, you know, was very important and instrumental to the designs of the Kuomintang state for this period.
Mm-hmm. And of course it has long, you know,
longer term impacts for these students as well, right? As you talk a little bit of in the conclusion, you note that some of these student groups who are interested in the frontier reemerge in the Mao era, and so in some of these students in particular throw all of their support behind, well intentioned campaigns for the voices of minority elites. So there's the wider impacts. Then there's also the slightly longer term after the grumbling was finished. There's a slightly longer term impact on these individuals as well, right?
Absolutely. Yes, that's right. In the end, when we look at Lan Guangdian, who didn't make it to the book, who does he reach out to in his campaign for wider representation of the Yi people? It's the students. He goes to university campuses because I think he understood in a very clever way that when it came to making politics visible, on the streets, in the media, students were a great way to connect with and make that voice amplify. So I think that's absolutely right to say. Yeah.
Mm. And of course, I mentioned the conclusion. And so in this particular part of the book, you talk about the students and you also, you point out that some of the other figures you mentioned in other parts of the book, have later reverberations as well, right? So you talk about how the anthropologists that we saw in chapter 4, some of them go on to work for the CCP. So there's longer, beyond the end of the book, some of these figures continue to be around and continue to be important. As of course the frontier continues to be around, it continues to be important. So it's quite a big question, but is there anything in particular that you want to emphasize here about the importance of the frontier in later periods? Sort of the final word on the frontier, at least as far as your book is concerned.
The final word or the final frontier, which sounds very Star Trek. I'm not saying anything very original here, but I think it's just a matter of looking at the news, where Xinjiang, Tibet, they are still viewed, from a Han Chinese view, as frontier areas. They're still areas that need to be, tamed, that they're unruly. And it just seems that a lot of lessons that, could have been learned from the period that I'm looking at, still not quite picked upon, by the current leadership, or maybe, among the wider population of China. I think one of the main issues that is still ongoing is this ongoing prejudice. When I've spoken to, and obviously I'm mentioning names, let's say a scholar at a university who is a non-Han Chinese, and he was telling me how he still would face a lot of prejudice in terms of who he was as a scholar, his work. So I think despite the fact that the frontier crisis is about, trying to bring down those gaps, people talk about the gaps all the time between, the China proper and the frontier areas, that we're in the 21st century, the year 2024, and I don't think that we have really any kind of diminishing, of that kind of level of understanding, and that what tools are used to diminish that gap seem to be, military rule, colonization. It seems that we seem to be very far away from what some of these anthropologists would have called for in the 1940s and 1950s.
Certainly moved very far away from trying to understand and trying to appreciate culture. Some of the anthropologists and figures that you talk about in the book. Well, I mean, as you said, it's not a new sentiment, but I think it's certainly an important one. So thank you for flagging that. But as with this, on that note, we've come to the end of your book and very nearly the end of our conversation. But Andres, as you know, now that this book is done, and congratulations for being finished with this, this project, what are you working on now? What is inspiring you at the moment?
Well, everything at the moment is about the Burma Road. That's my current project. I think I'm going back to my early trip in 1992. I'm going back to Yunnan. And I just have a very big interest in wartime connectivity. And my new project is about trying to understand how this particular road built between Burma, Yunnan, is really bringing about a new sense of understanding of geography, new networks, new connections, you know, and what does this mean for wartime China? And also, what does it mean in terms of how it connects to other parts of the world during that period? So it's an exciting project I'm very excited about. It's at its very, very early stages. And it's also, I'm already thinking about how to put this into a book. But hopefully you won't ask me what the book is going to look like, because there's so many, you know, just in terms of the chapters that I'm not quite sure what to do with, you know, at this moment. But it's a project I'm very excited about. I already presented my first AAS paper on it. And I'm looking forward to connecting, you know, with more scholars out there who are working on wartime connectivity, you know, similar regions, and, you know, really make a new contribution to the field.
I mean, it's, you said it, you know, it's a new project, but, you know, thinking of internationalism, the global connections, building new spaces, it seems like there's quite a few, you know, threads that connect between this book and your new project. But so I won't ask you what shape it's going to look like or how many chapters it's going to have. Best of luck with it. And I look forward to, you know, hearing more about it in the future. But for now, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about this book.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you very much.